a huge employer, and so it's almost, you know, sort of, it makes sense that they're going to be a powerful force in the legislature.
A look at what oil companies spend on lobbying in Juneau. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 25th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Alaska's senators on the student loan fix.
We have still a longer-term issue here. We have $1.2 trillion worth of debt that people are carrying on student loans, and I think should be refinanced at a much lower rate.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
There are over 10,000 registered lobbyists in Washington, D.C. By contrast, Juneau barely breaks the 100 mark. But even though they're a small tribe, they still wield plenty of influence in the state capital. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez has the story.
Money. Huge amounts of it blow into Juneau every January. There's the $9,000 reception that the Alaska Municipal League throws at the Baranoff Hotel. The $3,000 that Holland America spent flying in a former legislator to lobby on their behalf. The $2,000 that the Resource Development Council spent on booze and swag at an event celebrating women in energy. And these numbers don't even include the lobbying contracts themselves. All told, nearly 400 businesses, professional associations, and municipalities spent over $7 million lobbying the state legislature this session, according to reports collected by the Alaska Public Offices Commission. In just 90 days, lobbyists earned twice what all of Alaska's legislators get paid over the course of a full year.
It does seem rather high.
That's Peter Quist. He's the research director of the National Institute of Money and State Politics, which studies just what its name suggests. Because disclosure laws vary so much across the country, his group has only been able to get solid lobbying data from a handful of states. And when we run through a comparison of Alaska to the states he does have on file, the best match he has is Wisconsin.
I'm not sure exactly how the populations compare between Alaska and Wisconsin, but I would imagine that Wisconsin is substantially higher.
About 10 times higher. Their state budget is a lot bigger, too. But by the time the year wraps up, registered lobbyists in both places will probably earn about $15 million. So why is Alaska in the lobbying major leagues with a much more populated state? Quist says it might have something to do with Alaska's resource-based economy.
There are obviously some very vested interests there.
The oil and gas industry put more money toward lobbying this session than any other, spending over $1 million. With oil taxes being the biggest issue of the legislative session, their fleet of lobbyists were regulars in the Capitol as legislation lowering those taxes made its way from committee rooms to the governor's desk. ConocoPhillips had a team of four on contract, and BP had a full-time office in Juneau for its staff. None of the big three North Slope producers said okay to a taped interview about their lobbying efforts. But Kara Moriarty lobbies for the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, or AOGA, and she offered to give me her take.
It's no secret and should be no surprise that the oil and gas industry have expenses in Juneau that qualify as lobbying.
Moriarty says it would be strange if the oil industry didn't have a presence. You've got companies from Anheuser-Busch to Xerox all there, along with school districts, unions, hospitals, and municipalities. Oil dwarfs all of those groups in terms of its effect on Alaska's economy.
When we pay, you know, $6-$8 billion with a B in tax revenue, and our lobbying expenses are, you know, $1-2 million or whatever it was this past session, you know, it's a very minute part of the business that we do in Alaska.
Senator Hollis French voted against the oil tax cut and has campaigned for its repeal. But the Anchorage Democrat actually agrees with Moriarty's take on why the oil industry has an outsized influence in Juneau.
They're a huge employer, and so it's almost, you know, sort of, it makes sense that they're going to be a powerful force in the legislature.
And they wield that power in a pretty complex way. They spend their lobbying money on a mix of education and persuasion. They testify before committees, they meet with legislators, they put on receptions and host catered presentations called lunch and learns that are popular with legislative staff looking to get free food. They also fly lawmakers to the North Slope to check out their operations. In December, Conoco spent nearly $20,000 to send a dozen legislators up there, according to APOC filings. French says he's been on one of those trips, and that they're sort of a necessary evil if you're going to learn about how the oil industry operates.
There's no way to visit them and to see them without being a guest of the oil industry. Now, that being said, you know, just because you've taken a field trip to the North Slope shouldn't necessarily mean that you're in the bag for the industry.
While oil companies may spend $1 million or more each year on government relations, there isn't an equivalent force in opposition to them. Based on APOC reports and interviews with legislators, there wasn't a single registered lobbyist who was paid to push against legislation to lower taxes on oil companies. The closest you can get to that is David Gottstein, who helped found the advocacy organization Backbone. He traveled to Juneau this session in an effort to defeat the bill. He says at most, his group spent a few thousand dollars on lobbying legislators in Juneau. As far as what he thinks of how much the oil companies spend, he actually agrees that when you look at their overall budget, the industry isn't spending very much on lobbying, even if it seems like a lot in comparison to other groups. Gottstein characterizes it as an investment.
Why would they ever spend billions of dollars to enhance oil recovery, to make billions of dollars, if they can accomplish the same per share profit result by literally spending 1/1000th of that? Millions instead of billions by influencing and overwhelming our public policy debate.
So is this the best system we've got? Kathy Keeley works for the Sunlight Foundation, an open government group in Washington, D.C., and she says that lobbying can distort policy.
We're seeing just an enormous disparity on the side of corporate interests as opposed to consumer interests.
But Keeley says there are other ways people in groups without much money can have their voices heard. They just need to know what conversations are already happening. That means tracking government. All the transparency in the world is not going to do a thing if nobody's keeping an eye on it. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
If you want to track just where the money is going in Juneau, you can check out our interactive lobbying database at our website, alaskapublic.org. The proposed Livengood mining project would not break even at current gold prices. A feasibility study released by project developer International Tower Hill Mines shows profitable operation of the gold mine north of Fairbanks would require prices higher than $1,500 an ounce. Gold is currently selling in the $1,300 an ounce range, more than $500 below its 2011 peak. International Tower Hill Mines government and community relations manager Rick Soley says the study identifies Livengood as the fourth largest independent, undeveloped gold resource in the world, but with a future dependent on high gold prices.
That means that at $1,500 an ounce, the project would generate a minimal financial positive return. Really where it starts to show more optimistic results is as you get up into the $1,700-$1,800 per ounce.
The surface mine is estimated to cost about $2.8 billion to construct in its current 100,000 tons of ore per day configuration. Soley says developers are looking to rework the plan to better fit a lower gold price environment. He says International Tower Hill is still years away from making a decision on the Livengood project. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the IRS shuts down a Juneau business that dodged taxes for more than a decade.
You know, I've seen it go back, you know, several years, but it's rare that they would let it go that long.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The U.S. Senate passed a compromise measure to lower student loan interest rates. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the plan reduces rates for undergraduates and grad students enrolling in Alaska colleges this fall.
Subsidized Stafford loans, which go to lower and middle income students, doubled on July 1st because Congress failed to act on time. The compromise passed Wednesday night retroactively applies to loans taken out since that increase. The undergrad rate will be 3.9%, but that could increase because it's pegged to market rates. It comes with an 8.25% cap. That's something Senator Lisa Murkowski supports.
Is it permanent? Yes. Does it provide for all student loans? Yes. Does it put a cap so that there is some certainty to the student and their families? Yes.
The debate dragged on for more than a year. Congress delayed the rate increase last summer. Nobody wanted to vote on it in the middle of the presidential campaign. For the first time, Congress will be out of the rate-setting business. The plan permanently ties interest rates to the Treasury note. It also creates a tiered system for undergrads, graduate students, and PLUS loans. Senator Mark Begich voted with liberals on two amendments that ultimately failed. One would have ended the new rates in 2 years. The other would have locked in today's rate permanently. He supported the final package, but says it only addresses one element of financing college.
We have still a longer-term issue here. We have $1.2 trillion worth of debt that people are carrying on student loans that I think should be refinanced at a much lower rate.
That's an issue that will likely come up next year, and it's possible the rates will too, even though senators are touting them as permanent. Congress needs to reauthorize the Higher Education Act. Before that, the fix needs to pass the House. Leaders say that will happen early next week. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Does the cruise industry do enough to keep passengers safe, and how do we know if they don't? Those were among the questions asked at a U.S. Senate Commerce Committee meeting on Wednesday. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The focus was on the newly introduced Cruise Passenger Protection Act, sponsored by Committee Chairman Jay Rockefeller. The West Virginia Democrat cited recent fires and engine breakdowns, as well as incidents of onboard crime. He said the line's responses were not enough.
Is the industry really trying to adopt a culture of safety, or are the safety reviews and temporary investments a cynical effort to counter bad publicity?
About 1 million cruise ship passengers are visiting Alaska this season. Rockefeller said they and another 20 million American cruisers need more information about their rights as well as onboard safety. University of Newfoundland professor Ross Klein said liability waivers used by the lines are unreadable. Klein, who operates the Cruise Junkie website, said his research found the industry releases very little about rapes, assaults, robberies, and burglaries.
This analysis points to the need for better consumer protection of cruise passengers, much like the protections that are available to passengers on other modes of commercial transportation, including air carriers.
Industry representatives disputed those statements. Royal Caribbean International CEO Adam Goldstein said his corporation has joined the Carnival and Norwegian lines to offer more information.
The three largest cruise companies, making up over 85% of the cruise industry, have voluntarily agreed to expand that reporting by posting all allegations on our websites, regardless of whether an investigation was opened or closed.
He said the information will be available starting in August. The Cruise Lines International Association's 26 members recently instituted a passenger's bill of rights after a series of at-sea incidents. Cruise researcher Klein said parts appear to conflict with liability waivers still used by the lines. Alaska Democratic Senator Mark Begich, a committee member, said the government should work with the industry rather than create new regulations.
If there's some issues of disconnect between the rules that are on the ticket, and the detail of it, and what they're claiming to give to the public, then we should help make those aligned.
Despite concerns, industry critics and supporters agreed that crime rates are low on the big ships. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Coastal Villages Region Fund, the state's largest community development quota group, has been asking for more fish for their fishermen. It would require Congress amending the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act. In response, Alaska's congressional delegation says before pursuing changes to the program's fishing allocations, they would need a consensus. From Bethel, KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The delegation sent a letter to the CDQ's umbrella organization, Western Alaska Community Development Association, which states, quote, "While we remain open to hearing from the CDQ groups, we expect any issue brought to us for resolution to be supported unanimously by all six groups," end quote. Senator Lisa Murkowski says a consensus is not only important, it's required.
It is actually stated in the authorizing legislation.
It says that any changes to the CDQ plan are done with consent.
It's very difficult back here in Washington to get changes made to programs that are unique and specific to one state, in this case, specific only to Alaska. It's difficult to get those changes unless there is consensus.
The delegation is basically telling CVRF is you don't deserve the $10 million that they're supposed to get.
Dawson Hoover is a spokesperson for Coastal Villages Region Fund, which maintains they aren't getting their fair share of fishing allocations. The organization serves 20 villages in the lower Kuskokwim region, one of the poorest in the state. They have 9,300 residents, thousands more than most other CDQ groups, and believe they should also have more fish. Their halibut season just wrapped up. It took 2.5 weeks to take their allocation of 210,000 pounds. Hoover says that's 195,000 pounds less than what they deserve.
And the residents aren't happy. They're not happy that they cut the season short. And we should still be fishing right now, but we're not getting our fair share.
CVRF earns about $100 million a year, but they could be making more, according to Hoover. The catches of halibut, along with pollock, crab, and cod, pay for programs to develop the economy in the lower Kuskokwim, such as subsidizing the salmon fishery. If allocations change the way CVRF wants them to, some other smaller groups would get less fish. The Aleutian Pribilof Island Community Development Association serves 6 remote communities and about 390 people. This year, they are allowed about 354,000 pounds of halibut, which would likely decrease in the future. Besides CVRF, one other CDQ group, the Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation, would profit from an allocation change by approximately $10 million a year. They serve about 9,000 residents in 15 communities in northwest Alaska. Tyler Rhodes, spokesperson for the Norton Sound Group, says their board of directors doesn't think the allocations are perfect, but they don't want to seek any changes right now.
Engaging in an allocation battle is currently not in the best interest of NSCDC, nor is it for our constituents.
He says since the allocations were set in 2006, the group has had a great deal of success. CVRF will continue to push for an allocation change. Red T-shirts with the slogan, "Just Fix CDQ" on the front, have been cropping up in the Bethel region. Hoover says it's what the residents are asking for, and eventually the delegation will have to listen. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com.
Specific items are being requested to help flood-impacted communities in the interior, including Galena, where the most severe and wide-ranging breakup damage occurred. State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management spokesman Jeremy Zidek urges people wanting to help to consider what's needed before making donations.
At this time, the folks in Galena need tools for reconstruction, building materials, non-perishable foods, kitchen goods, cleaning supplies, dog food, other pet care products.
Zidek says shipping to Galena and other flood-impacted villages like Circle is high, and donations have to be prioritized according to what's immediately in demand.
The needs are going to change as we go down the road, and what we want folks to do is call the toll-free number 1-855-374-4790. Talk to one of the volunteer donation managers, and they'll be able to identify exactly the goods that are needed at this time.
Zidek says drop-offs or pickups can be arranged. He says some donations, particularly clothing, sometimes just pile up. He says cash is an effective way to help, and there are several charitable organizations taking donations to aid flood victims. A Douglas man and his businesses owe $1 million in back taxes that have been due since 1999. The Internal Revenue Service in May seized PP's Douglas Inn, formerly known as Louie's. The agency plans to auction off the downtown Douglas property to recoup some of the money owed to the federal government. KTOO's Matt Miller reports.
Patrick Peterson declined to say during a recent interview how much he really owes, but 11 federal tax liens totaling $997,000 were filed against Peterson and his company Peterson Pacific Holdings between July of 2011 and June of 2013. He's also been prosecuted twice, and there have been efforts to revoke his probation at least three times in the past 10 years for failing to file or remit Juneau sales taxes. Peterson blamed ongoing expenses for his and his daughter's legal issues as one reason for not paying the taxes.
Paperwork is not my big suit.
Were you doing all the paperwork yourself?
I was trying to, but I just couldn't keep up with it. And up until 1999, I had a good bookkeeper that was taking care of it for me, so I had everything caught up with.
Peterson says he still hoped to get his bar back. State property records indicate that Peterson signed over his property, a quit claim deed, in exchange for $1 to Carol Collier of Riverview, Florida, back in May.
Yeah, I tried to transfer it to protect it, but it didn't work.
The property is assessed at $242,000. The liens filed by the federal government were for unpaid federal employer taxes during most of the reporting periods from first quarter of 1999 to fourth quarter of 2012. They also include efforts to recover employees' federal Social Security and Medicare withholding that Peterson was supposed to pass on to the federal government, also as early as 1999.
That's letting it go pretty far.
Professor Scott Schumacher is director of the graduate program in taxation at the University of Washington School of Law. He also worked as a trial attorney for the U.S. Department of Justice Tax Division and has represented clients as a private attorney in tax issues.
You can see that, you know, there's been a problem with that business since 1999. So we're going on close to 15 years. You know, I've seen it go back, you know, several years, but it's rare that they would let it go that long.
Schumacher says continued non-payment of such taxes is common, especially among struggling businesses.
So if a business is in financial trouble and they have cash flow issues, you know, and they're saying, okay, if I don't pay my suppliers, they're not going to give me any inventory, and if I don't have inventory, I'm out of business. Now, the IRS, I can, you know, I'll just one quarter or one month, I'll do better. And the IRS isn't going to shut me down, so they think. And so that's kind of how it works. And then they think, okay, well, all I need to do is get through this month and I'll be fine.
What is odd is why the IRS decided to seize the property now after over 13 years of delinquent payments. Schumacher says the IRS is usually in contact with a taxpayer with almost immediate notices. Field staff are eventually assigned to work with them and get them caught up. Closure of a business and seizure of a property is usually a measure of last resort.
I must say that shutting down of a business or seizure of a business is fairly rare.
The IRS has warning notices posted on PP's Douglas Inn. Agency officials declined to comment on the record for this story, but they did say an auction of the property is planned for later this year. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
The invasive aquatic plant Elodia is growing in a few Alaska freshwater sites, and work continues to fight it back. KUAC's Dan Bross reports on a new tool being used in the battle with Elodia.
A gas-powered suction dredge, more typically employed to suck up gold-rich sediment, is being used to vacuum up the prolific weed known for crowding out native plants and fish. Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District invasive plant specialist Darcy Echeverry is leading the fight to rid Chena Slough and other local waters of Elodia. Her latest weapon is a 16-foot dredge-equipped boat.
So this is our pontoon boat that we have a suction dredge mounted to, and it's set up to be scuba diver operated. This metal bin on the back is a sluiceway, and it's got different compartments with bags attached to the bottom that the Elodia and water will flow into, and the bags will fill up with Elodia. The water will filter out and go back into the slough or the lake, wherever we're working. So as if one compartment fills, you just close this off, and the next bag will fill up.
Atcheverry led a team that tested the new dredge boat at the Chena Lakes Recreation Area in North Pole, successfully sucking up several bags of Elodia, including the roots. Chena Lakes Rec Area Manager Ricky Borland points to the water around the boat launch, where Elodia is growing prolifically.
Yeah, you can see there's a pretty good little clump there, and yeah, over in that area it's definitely thicker. We don't want it to start choking out the fish populations and the other species that are in there.
The pontoon dredge boat's big challenge is Chena Slough, where Elodia was first detected in 2010 and has grown along 10 miles of the waterway in North Pole. Atcheverry says it'll be a test of the mechanical harvest versus another approach to Elodia eradication.
We haven't eliminated herbicides from our toolbox, and we're planning on using this for 3 weeks this summer and cleaning up a half-mile stretch of Chena Slough. And we'll use that information of how long it takes us and how much fuel we burn, how much manpower hours, to really evaluate.
Elodia is a problem in waters worldwide. It's suspected to have made it to Fairbanks via a dumped aquarium and has also cropped up in lakes in Anchorage and Cordova. Atcheverry says the Elodia suction dredge boat, the first in Alaska, is modeled after one successfully used to combat aquatic weeds in the state of Maine. It was purchased with federal funds and will be available for use statewide. The Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District is looking for people to help out with the Chena Slough project, including taking bags of collected Elodia for composting. In North Pole, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld and Matt Miller in Juneau, and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fife. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Executive Search, providing temporary or full-time staffing for over 36 years, from executive and technical placement to medical in-office staffing. Alaska Executive Search, online at akexec.com. And by ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskananookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.